Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, Director, and welcome to this, the third of the centenary series of Director's Lectures. In a way, it's a climax if we look at the title, The School, the Future, and the Social Sciences. And I find my chairman's task blessedly easy tonight and straightforward. Our speaker, after all, is famous for being able to speak for himself brilliantly and commandingly. And anyway, he is well known and respected worldwide for his role at the school as the director since 1990. No doubt, at the time he was appointed, it was thought of as a surprising appointment, surprising and even for LSE radical. After all, he was not a social scientist, but a microbiologist. After Oxford, he proved a gifted scientist. He was foundation professor of biology at the University of Essex 20 years ago. I recall Lord Dainton, the chemist himself, explaining to the LSE court that among Dr. Ashworth's achievements was a distinguished book on slime. How many of us can say that of our friends? Recruited on secondment in 1976 from Essex, Dr. Ashworth joined the Central Policy Review of the Cabinet as its chief scientific advisor, advising Prime Ministers Callaghan and Thatcher in his time, and the Secretary of the Cabinet, Lord Hunt, is on record as describing him as a multidisciplined, open-minded man with the ability to reach firm decisions. And I think that was proved memorably when in 1981 he became Vice Chancellor of the University of Salford, which at that time has its fortunes had eroded to the point of peril. I put it mildly when I say Dr. Ashworth transformed Salford's fortunes. He allied higher education and business and the community in a way which has proved an enduring model for other growing universities. By the time he arrived here, Dr. Ashworth had a remarkable perspective of business and government, science and technology, and he was one of those rare birds combining all that also with service on the boards of major corporations, still on the board of Granada and Sainsbury. So maybe he was not a social scientist, but he had the experience to value the merits of LSE naturally with respect, but without awe. And from the start, his contribution has been challenging and innovative, forthright, far-seeing. I think back to the very start of his directorship, about the time the school was trying to put its act together for fundraising in the 90s and beyond, for the centenary and beyond. And I remember him saying simply that we could seek support and resources in order to change. We could not expect support if it merely was that we wanted to remain the same. And certainly change is a condition of life in higher education today. And I know that Dr. Ashworth has devoted himself with immense courage and enthusiasm and imagination to safeguarding the school's essential qualities while responding flexibly to formidable pressures upon us in our quality niche in the system. When the next history of the LSE is written, the Ashworth years will be remembered for his innovation and enthusiasm, the real progress in developing new courses, standards of teaching, student recruitment, academic support services, site strategy, and the generation of income through contract research and the LSE Foundation. I'm just taking the last of those two priorities for us. I think that when John arrived, I think there were 37,000 square meters. On site, we now have 46,000 square meters, and that doesn't include the acquisition of the Royalty Theatre, Coup de Théâtre, and residency student accommodation has again more than doubled from 1,065 rooms to 2,326 rooms. And if you think of the funded research activities, they've grown from 3.6 million to 8.8 million. There is a formidable momentum in our affairs. A great deal of credit to our director for that. No wonder we have the old theatre agog, John, to hear your views on the school, the future, and the social sciences.
Chairman, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for that typically warm and supportive introduction. Well, this series of lectures started, most appropriately, with Lord Dahrendorf talking about the history of the school and introducing his masterly survey of our first century, the publication of which officially launched our centenary celebrations earlier this summer. Dr. I.G. Patel then followed with a survey of the world within which the school has to operate and suggested some improvements that might be made to that global environment and how LSE might, in general, help to bring about a better and more equitable world. I want to finish this centenary series of director's lectures by continuing that theme, but coming a little nearer to home by concentrating on the academic environment within which the LSE will have to operate in the near future, and speculate on how that environment might change and thus present the school with new opportunities in its second century, which is, of course, just about to begin. Well, let me start then with a quick sketch of the higher education system of which we are still such an integral part. The British universities have just gone through one of the most dramatic expansions in their history. I think it's best to remember, though, that there have actually been two periods of expansion since the 1950s. The first, usually associated with the report of the Royal Commission chaired by another famous LSE figure, Professor Lord Robbins, involved the de novo creation of a number of new universities and an increase in the age participation rate, that is to say, the proportion of any age cohort that goes on to tertiary education, an increase in that age participation rate from about 5% to about 10%. However, if one looks at the composition of the student body in more detail at that time, and particularly at the social background from which the students came and the gender balance in the universities, it can be seen that most of that increase was actually due to the middle classes deciding that it was now safe to send their daughters as well as their sons to university. It was also accompanied, by the way, by the closure of a number of finishing schools on the continent. Despite valiant attempts at some of the then new universities, such as Sussex, there was actually little change in the curriculum or the nature of the universities themselves. And indeed, until the mid-1990s, we still had one of the lowest age participation rates of working-class children in British universities of any advanced industrialised country. Well, the recent expansion over the last 4 or 5 years has been quite different. It's been characterised by the conversion of a number of existing institutions, the former polytechnics, into universities by Act of Parliament, and has involved the creation, for the first time in the United Kingdom, of a mass rather than an elite university system. The student body, which is now over 1 million strong, looks much more like a cross-section of the population at large and has a majority of what, until only a few years ago, were called non-standard students. That is to say, adults over 21, often doing courses part-time. And within this mass system, the traditional elite universities of Oxford, Cambridge and London, which between them comprised a little over 25% of the entire system in 1939, now comprise less than 5%. So the first question, I think, that I should address is whether this expansion will continue. I am sure it will. Although we think that at an age participation rate of just over 30%, we have a lot of students going to universities, in international terms, this is actually still a rather low figure, at least for an advanced industrialized country. The French in 1990, for example, announced a target of an 80% age participation rate for the new millennium. The demand for university-level education and training seems insatiable in the United Kingdom, and all the evidence is that commerce, industry, and the public service will be demanding more, not fewer, graduates in the next 100 years. And even in the present difficult situation, with general unemployment worryingly high, unemployment amongst graduates is lower than the average, and demand for graduates this summer by employers was considerable, with a number of firms complaining that they could not find enough of the right kind. And this raises the second question I want to discuss. Will these graduates be studying the right subjects and in the right way? Well, answers to these questions require some kind of view, of course, of what society in general and employers in particular will be like in 2020, when those now graduating will probably be at their most productive. And this in turn requires some view to be taken of the rate and nature of technological and social change between now and then. But before I turn to that, it is, I think, pretty much accepted that a mass system of higher education, like the one we now have, has a number of characteristics which differentiate it from an elite one. And let me just list these without discussing them in detail, for I imagine that they're well known, at least to this audience. The first characteristic that I want to draw attention to is that in a mass system, a bachelor's degree qualification, and in this mass system, which I'm going to define as one with an age participation rate of 30% or more, a bachelor's degree qualification is a general rather than a specialized qualification of the honors degree kind. It is obtained after taking a 3-year course of study, often organized on a modular course unit basis, leading to a pass-fail examination with a significant amount of credit given to coursework. Secondly, in such a bachelor's program, the acquisition of certain skills or competencies is regarded as at least as important as the assemblage of academic knowledge. And these skills, by the way, have been very usefully and succinctly spelt out by the Association of Graduate Recruiters in their recent booklet, Skills for Graduates in the 21st Century. And third, specialized professional skills, such as those required by the academic, legal, medical, engineering, or other professions, together with whatever specialist knowledge is required by those professions, is taught in the course of a 1 or more years master's program, offered either by specialized professional schools or by the graduate school of a university which also happens to offer bachelor's degrees. The Higher Education Funding Councils of England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland are all, with the help of the Higher Education Quality Council, encouraging the now more than 100 British universities down this path. And the merger of the Departments of Education and Employment, a merger in which, it is interesting to note, former civil servants from the Department of Employment seem to have been appointed to all the key policy-making positions, will ensure that, whoever wins the next election, the pace of change will continue at a rate slightly faster than the academic community, at least in the old universities, will find comfortable. Of course, there is resistance, especially from Oxbridge colleges, which do not take kindly to the notion that they should become increasingly dominated by postgraduate rather than undergraduate teaching. But I think, as with management schools, which were set up by those universities more than 15 years after everyone else had developed them, I have no doubt that eventually they will either go private and thus form a privileged tier of tertiary education comparable to the public schools at secondary level, or they will conform to what will by then be the common practice of British universities. But all of this is to dwell on the minutiae of academic organisation and politics, fascinating to those of us in the middle of it, but not, if I'm honest, really to many others. And in a sense, the real drivers of change are those technological and social factors to which universities must, like everyone else, both contribute and conform. So let me now return to them. Well, given the rate of technologically driven change that we are currently seeing, and the perhaps even more profound social changes associated with the current changes in family structure and demography, it's clearly rash to make any predictions. But let me just point to the two key technologies that will certainly drive change in the next few decades, and one of which, the first that I want to mention, has been claimed by some to provide a serious challenge to universities as we know them. Now, that technological innovation is, of course, that in electronic communication, which now means that anything that can be expressed in digital form can be handled by machines and transported from one part of the globe to any other at near zero marginal cost. Of course, the cost of the infrastructure, that's to say the satellites, the cables, the computer switches, and so on, is very high. But once that is in place, and very largely it now is, then the marginal cost of transporting an additional digit is essentially zero. all intellectual constructs can in principle be expressed in digital form, and one particular construct, money, is of course of particular importance, or at least interest. Consequently, as you all know, a market in different kinds of money, including derivatives of money, and including, of course, derivatives of money, has been constructed, and that is global in scope. But important to remember that money is only one kind of intellectual construct, and when in digital form, others can be treated in exactly the same way. And in particular, the same machines that enable the global financial markets to operate can also carry digitized text and thus enable assessments of, for example, political risk, as well as straightforward economic information and data to be displayed on screen-based services such as that provided by Reuters, in dealing rooms, ministers of finance, schools of economics, and elsewhere. And of course, this is now routinely done. Indeed, the LSE, in a joint venture with the research consultancy company IDEA, run, as it happens, by one of our alumni, is one of those actively and profitably providing that kind of service online as I speak. Well, since this market is continuous through time as well as space, those few centres in which the trading is largely conducted need to be located at points about 8 hours removed one from another. And the consequence of this has been the growing importance as financial centres of London, Tokyo and New York. Paradoxically, therefore, the establishment of a global market has enhanced the economic importance and specialisation of some cities, or at least city regions, at the expense of the nation-states that contain them. This global market, still in its infancy, will develop, and the infrastructure that sustains it, which in turn is part of the so-called global information superhighway, about which politicians like Al Gore and Tony Blair get so excited, will be financed and supported by the needs of the financial markets, which are now quite inconceivable without it. Interestingly, and I think highly significantly, this information superhighway is not under the control of any single nation or interest, and indeed was deliberately designed in that way by the United States Department of Defense, who wanted a decentralized and secure communication system that will be capable of operating after a nuclear attack on the Western Alliance by the USSR. Ironically, therefore, the global information superhighway might well be the most significant and longest-lasting legacy of the Cold War. Certainly, I cannot conceive of any state, and certainly not the United States of America, designing it or providing the funds to finance it initially without the stimulus provided by the terrors of that period. But be that as it may, the question now is, what else might that infrastructure be used for? And to sharpen up the point a bit, if indeed any intellectual construct can be expressed in digital form, as I have asserted, could the education that is provided by universities be provided at a distance by such a virtual university, in which the university went to the student, rather than, as at present, the student going to the university? Well, I'm sure that such virtual universities will be created, and we have, of course, a head start on such things in the United Kingdom with the Open University. And I'm sure that they will find a niche in the overall provision of tertiary education. However, whilst the pedagogical techniques that will thus be pioneered will be used by more traditional universities to supplement and complement what they have traditionally done, I do not think for a moment that they provide a serious threat in any institutional sense, as others, such as Sir Douglas Haig in his pamphlet Beyond Universities, A New Republic of the Intellect, or more recently, Michael Prowse in the Financial Times of the 20th of November, have suggested. The reason is a simple one. The knowledge and information that a university purveys to its students, and which is apparently its function, is not, of course, an end in itself, but just a means to an end. What society has always wanted from its universities, from the time they were invented in Western Europe during the 13th century to the present, is an appropriately educated and self-confident elite capable of managing that society well. Well, of course, each of the words in that sentence begs a lot of questions. and the answers to them are and were quite different in 13th century Oxford, 19th century Berlin, or 20th century Stanford, just to take three universities which were outstanding examples of the genre in their day. I also suspect that even more than in the past centuries, the next will need its universities to ensure that that elite is self-critical as well as self-confident. Indeed, this could well become a key role and justifies, if justification is needed, the devotion of so much university resource to research and scholarship, as well as teaching and learning, and that's a point I want to come back to. So the most successful universities in the next century will thus be the ones that best embody what the 21st century will mean by those words appropriate, elite, and education in that definition of the purpose of universities that I gave a moment ago. Well, what do I think those definitions will be? Well, whatever they might be, I do not think they can be delivered by a virtual institution. Our university's graduates need information and knowledge. Well, of course they do. But society wants its elites to be wise, and we only know of one way whereby the young can learn to acquire the means to acquire wisdom, real contact and intellectual discussion and argument with peers whom they respect. We know enough about the information superhighway already to know that whatever else it doesn't provide that kind of interaction. Well, the technical, academic content of the courses that a university provides is, of course, important. And the most appropriate content will, though, be much more diverse in the future, in a mass system, than in the past. In particular, those key city regions that currently run the global financial economy of the kind that I described a moment ago will have a very special responsibility and duty to provide an education suitable for those who will run and regulate that global marketplace. Such an institution would obviously need to provide courses in economics and finance, but also in sociology, anthropology, international relations, information technology, and since it's always helpful to know why we have to start from where we happen to be at any one time, courses in history and psychology might well prove useful together, since regulation is at the heart of any well-run and stable market, knowledge of law, public administration, and the managerial sciences. Some of you will have realized by now that I've just described the current provisions at the LSE. But although necessary, I do not think that that list is sufficient. Because the financial markets are global, it will be vital for the student body to be, like that market, international in character. Currently, just over half the students at the LSE, at least those in Houghton Street, are non-British nationals, and I'll be returning to that point again at the end of my talk. Let me, though, just mention briefly that other technological change which is on our intellectual horizon and which will transform the next century and, indeed, the next millennium. Molecular genetics and genetic engineering. It is now perfectly feasible to set out to discover the chemical structure of all the human chromosomes, and under the title of the Human Genome Project, this is currently being done. We are a few decades away from having as complete a description of a human being in terms of a four-letter alphabet as we have of the two-letter alphabet of the software that underpins the global digital information network. Now, of course, such a description no more tells one all there is to know about the one than it does about the other. But such knowledge could well transform many, but of course not necessarily all, of the social sciences. No one has really thought through the implications of this, and I don't have time to do so tonight. But let me just remind you of one obvious implication. We all of us carry in our chromosomes a chemical record of our ancestry. And so, for the first time, it will be possible to begin to answer some of those tantalizing and teasing questions of the where have I come from and where do I belong kind definitively, or at least far more definitively than ever before. The application of evolutionary theory to the social sciences, many of which have never been able to do more than assume that the hereditable component in what they are studying was small, unknowable, and thus necessarily had to be neglected, will produce social sciences far different from any that we can envisage now. The Darwin seminars, which have been organised in this past year by Helena Cronin under the auspices of the Centre for the Philosophy of the Natural and Social Sciences, have shown, not without controversy, how issues as disparate as the nature of aggression and war and the changing shape of female bodies and definitions of female beauty can be illuminated in unexpected ways by the light shed on them by recent advances in evolutionary biology. What has surprised me about these seminars, the clearest example I can think of during my directorship of that mission to study tomorrow's problems today that we've always claimed for ourselves, has been the wide range of people and professions that have been attracted to them. This suggests to me that the study of genetics and evolutionary theories will be as central to future definitions of appropriate education, at least for the elite, as mathematics, language, and philosophy are today. But it will not only be in disciplinary or curriculum matters that we shall see impacts. I'm sure that the combination of a secure theoretical underpinning to cognitive neuroscience, which is in sight but currently lacking, coupled with evolutionary social psychology, which is currently scarcely in its infancy as a science, will give rise to our advances in our understanding of how learning takes place and consequently how it might be expedited, that will, pace Dougie Haig and Michael Prowse, quite dwarf any impacts of the information superhighway. I'm also sure that the universities of that day will take such discoveries in their stride and incorporate them into their traditional offerings, as they always have done. If I'm right, then, the impact of the first of my two technological changes will be to give a small but significant boost to the ability of students to acquire knowledge and perhaps some forms of training at a distance, and to give the opportunity of some university institutions in London, Tokyo, and New York to develop curricula designed to provide the education needed by that global elite who will run and regulate global financial markets. That second technological change will, because it directly concerns our knowledge of our biological nature, and thus our capacity to manipulate that nature, be more long-term, more profound, and I've probably said all that can usefully be said about it now, except, of course, to remind you of the obvious point that the LSE, or at least some of its directors, have always been alert for the time when biology and the social sciences might have something serious to say to each other. The last time that the climate seemed propitious, there was a sad and rather disheartening dialogue of the deaf, or at least that's how I read Lord Dahrendorf's Chapter 4, which I commend to you. With hindsight, I think it's clear that the biologists were nothing like ready for the dialogue, and the social scientists were only too well aware of that fact. This time, I hope the outcome will be both more fruitful and rewarding, since the biologists are nothing like as arrogant as they were in the 1930s, and the social sciences are without doubt a lot more sophisticated and ready, I think, for the stimulus of a fresh methodological approach. Let me close this part of my argument by returning to a point perhaps I slid over too quickly. I pointed out that thanks to the fact that the global financial markets was continuous in time as well as in space, three cities, London, Tokyo, and New York, had a highly privileged position. This is true. But it is, of course, true of cities and city regions in general, and not just restricted to the particular case of financial markets in three particular cities. The consequence of our creating a world trading system that is increasingly based, either, as I've described, on a global market, as with financial services and some other products, or on multinational regional free trade areas, such as the European Union, NAFTA, and APEC, for physical, and by physical I mean non-digitizable goods, is that effective economic power has drained away from nation states and migrated either to multinational bodies or to cities or city regions. Each of these has begun to develop their own specialized economy, which will, as with the financial services of the City of London, require underpinning by suitably specialized university institutions. Thus, London's leading position in the global music market, not surprisingly, leads to our having some of the best musical education in the world. And similarly, our position as one of the leading centres for media and design-based industries leads to our having some of the finest institutions for education in art and design in the world. And all that I've said about the opportunities for the LSE, thanks to the special nature of the London economy, could thus be rephrased in terms of the opportunities for institutions such as the Guildhall School of Music and the universities with which it is associated, and the London Institute with its five component colleges, albeit, I suppose, with less certainty that London is in those areas, necessarily as far ahead of, say, Milan, Paris, or Berlin as it is in the field of international finance. I suspect that the City of London will increasingly realise the force of this argument, recognise the need to fund appropriately those specialist institutions on which its particular and increasingly peculiar economy will come to depend, and wherever the school is located, I hope that we can be sure that we will be one of those institutions privileged to receive their financial support. In conclusion, let me return, as I promised, to the question of the importance of the national composition of the student body. My picture of the developing British university system is one that is differentiated, and increasingly differentiated, into a number of qualitatively different kinds of activity, some of which may well be brigaded together in institutions called universities, but not all of them need necessarily be. First, there will be the large teaching-orientated undergraduate schools offering general degrees to a third or more of the age cohort. Second, there will be, at least for a decade or two, small, specialised, and in England almost certainly socially exclusive undergraduate schools in which honours degrees of the present kind may still be taught. Third, there will be a number of specialist institutions teaching subjects based on craft skills such as music, art and design, and possibly some kinds of engineering, which will also offer specialised undergraduate education. Fourth, there will also, of course, need to be a wide variety of professional schools, such as medical, law, engineering, theological, and they may well coexist with more academic schools in which master's level qualifications of a wide variety of kinds, as well as the LLM and the Bachelor of Surgery and so on, will be offered. And fifth and finally, there will need to be research centres within which doctoral level programmes are offered. I should perhaps pause here for just a moment on this last fifth point, the need for research centres and their relationship with doctoral programmes, since it is so crucial to us here at the LSE. There is a close connection between research and doctoral and master's teaching, and these activities may well be brigaded together for managerial and academic convenience into graduate schools in many of our universities. And the proper development and management of these could well, therefore, be another special feature of institutions such as the LSE if, as I suggested earlier, it will be necessary for next century's elites to be not only self-confident, but also more self-critical. And let me emphasise that point. One vital function which the traditional universities have performed in Western democracies has been the production of critical commentaries of their society's activities and actions based on serious and sustained scholarly research. This is one of the strengths of our societies, perhaps the strength, and one which, for example, the universities of the Soviet Union conspicuously failed to provide. We must be sure that we do not fall into the same self-regarding trap and help others to avoid it too. I was struck when in Chile recently, for example, to note how concerned those I met, and inevitably I suppose I must remember that they were biased to LSE alumni, so probably they're not an accurate cross-section of Chilean society. But at least they impressed me with the need for a new approach, particularly to social welfare, appropriate to their recently restructured free market economy. This is the result of the economic reforms introduced by the so-called Chicago Boys, that's to say those Chilean economists educated at the University of Chicago, largely in the period 1965 to 80, and whose reforms have led to 11 consecutive years of sustained growth of GDP of about between 6 and 7% per annum. It is an economic growth record with which the Chancellor would have been proud a couple of days ago. But there was also concern expressed by those I met with the need to introduce more quickly than seems likely an appropriate regulatory regime for the free markets that have been so created. And certainly if Chile is to achieve its aspiration of becoming the financial center of Southern America, then I am sure that this is essential. And much interest was expressed in the possibility that the LSE could help in this, as with help on the social welfare front. They clearly felt that what they'd got from the University of Chicago was splendid as far as it went, but it didn't, of course, go quite all the way. Similarly, I think it was both right and appropriate that the school not only responded to the request for advice with economic restructuring from Russia and other members of the former Warsaw Pact, but also offered, with help from the World Bank, to write what has been termed the Beveridge Report for Central and Eastern Europe. And one of the pleasures of my time as director was to see the gratitude and respect with which that report was received when it was presented recently in Prague, and the foreword, which was written to the published version by President Havel, nicely underlined, at least for me, the importance of ensuring that those who are responsible for developing those fragile economies have a constructively critical attitude to the economic theories that they, like the Chileans a little earlier, are in the process of putting into practice. Coming back to Britain, I think it's vital that as we develop this highly differentiated university system that I've been describing, and the institutional differentiation that I've described is happening, I think, much faster than is sometimes generally realized, that we too do not lose sight of the fact that the standards adopted by the various parts of the whole system be closely tied into those of our international competitors. One of the mistakes that was made by those who developed our comprehensive system of secondary education in the 1960s was to forget that whatever it is that we want to do for our own social purposes, the ultimate test of any education system is whether or not its products are as good as those produced by others. We must not make that mistake as we create what is in effect a comprehensive system of tertiary education. It will be the task of the graduate schools of our universities to ensure that we remain in touch with international best practice and to make sure that the right balance is then maintained between the standards of the undergraduate and graduate schools. The challenge of academic managers will be to get that balance between the two standards right, whilst, of course, maintaining the highest possible quality of provision at all levels. Given the financial constraints imposed by the government at present, that's quite a tall order, and I must confess that I personally do not think it can be done. If some, at least, of our universities are to remain internationally competitive, then I'm afraid there is going to have to be more resources provided to them. The LSE is a case in point, and I've already mentioned the strategic importance, as I see it, of our convincing the City of London that they need us to underpin their long-term future, just as much as I suspect we would welcome their financial support. I mentioned earlier that approximately half our students currently are non-British, one of the highest percentages of foreign students of any university institution in Britain. As significant for the future, though, is the fact that half of our students are graduate students, and of course amongst them there is a preponderance of non-British students. The LSE is thus clearly on track to be one of those institutions to which the British university system must look to maintain contact with best international practice and to ensure that the standards of the British system do not depart from that international best. So there are at least two reasons why I think it's important for the LSE to maintain a broad international base for its student body. The first is our privileged position in London, one of the three world cities, and the second is our role as having one of the leading graduate schools in the British university system. And I want to finish by posing the question of how such an institution may or should evolve as those responsibilities become increasingly important and the provision of undergraduate education becomes relatively less important. Clearly, one obvious change is that the national composition of the staff might begin to reflect that of the student body. This has actually begun to happen at the LSE. This year, of some 50 new junior members of staff, approximately half were non-British by nationality. The further up the academic hierarchy of the LSE you look, the higher the proportion of British national one sees, as one would expect, since it takes time for a lecturer to become a professor. But interestingly, amongst the seven new senior staff, that's to say the professors and readers, that have been appointed to the LSE from institutions, from other institutions, that's appointed from outside rather than promoted, during this past academic year, four have been recruited from foreign universities, and three are not of British nationality. I should make it clear, in case there's any doubt, that there is no policy to appoint professors or any other grade of staff, come to that, of any particular nationality. There is only one clear policy, and that is to appoint the best that we can. It is, however, I think, an interesting and I would say significant fact that in carrying out that policy, we are rather rapidly acquiring an international teaching staff to complement our international student body. Having such a large percentage of non-British teaching staff, of course, presents some particular management problems. Such recruits cannot necessarily be expected to know what is expected of a university teacher in a British institution. And the training system that I remember when I was a beginning lecturer in the early 1960s, and which, if I remember it aright, assumed that I was a scholar and a gentleman, and would therefore know instinctively how to conduct myself, is clearly inadequate. We have a major problem of staff training and career development to address, the dimensions of which we have only just begun to glimpse. Then there is the problem of the curriculum. In an institution where the majority of the students and an increasing fraction of the staff are non-British, to what extent should the curriculum reflect global or international concerns, and to what extent should it reflect national or regional ones? Well, as I indicated at the beginning of my talk, here I think the LSE is lucky. Since the financial system is inherently global, there's really not much of an issue for us, based as we are in London. For other institutions, though, I think it'll prove more difficult. For many, if not all, American universities, for example, international education, as they call it, really consists of giving non-Americans an American education. And similar things could be said about some other British universities. I suspect, in fact, that there is both an internationally relevant curriculum and an internationally relevant description of graduate skills and competencies that institutions like the LSE will be developing in the next century, and which will be our contribution to the diversity that is going to characterize the British system as a whole. Just to take an obvious point, that publication of the Association for Graduate Recruiters that I was commending earlier makes no mention of linguistic skills. Is it really wise for us to produce so many monolingual graduates from our British students? Well, there has been little recognition from the British government or its agencies of the special needs of those of us in a position to develop internationally significant graduate schools. But the European Union has recognized the challenges posed. Through its Erasmus, and more recently its Socrates programs, student mobility has been promoted greatly to the benefit of the British university system. But little has been done to develop what I would term a genuinely international approach to curriculum and skill or competence issues. Like much else in contemporary university management, these fundamental topics have to be pursued as and when time can be found in an increasingly detailed agenda that sometimes seems to be set by those more interested in accountancy than in academic matters. However, I suspect that many, if not most, of my predecessors would have had similar grumbles. Successful university management has probably always consisted of moving towards long-term goals by opportunistic and highly tactical steps. Opportunities will arise in the future, which will need to be spotted for what they are, rather than for what they are said to be, quickly seized, and the attendant risks borne by those far-sighted enough to see where they should be leading their institution. The LSE has been fortunate in its managers and their leadership in the past, and Lord Ralph Dahrendorf's book is, in its later chapters, as fascinating about how they have reconciled the conflicting pressures that came upon them as it is in the earlier parts about the school's origins. I'm sure that this good fortune will continue into the LSE's second century, which of course shows every signs of being as exciting and demanding as was its first. Thank you very much.
Director's custom to hope that all lecturers will be open to questions, and this is our moment, I think. Are there questions to the director? Please.
I mean, this is a view that I mean, just Dougie Haig's and Michael Prowse's view, and it's one that has been expressed by many others. I mean, they've got predecessors, and British universities up and down the land are proud possessors of enormous white elephants called audio-visual units, some of them extensively equipped with film making equipment. It's all gathering dust and has never been used, except by the occasional enthusiast, because I think there is one very important fact which those enthusiasts forgot, which is that this kind of activity looks like a monologue, but it isn't, because you are receiving all sorts of body signals from me. You are getting a lot of non-verbal communication. I see there the professor of psychology who will tell me what fraction of non-verbal communication there is in any conversation. I think it's about 50% or thereabouts, it is believed. And students, of course, go to lectures for many and various purposes, part of which is to be inducted into a profession and to receive all those non-verbal bits of communication, which actually any good lecturer is extremely skilled at doing. Having said that, of course, there is a room for computer-assisted learning. An awful lot of tedious stuff. I'm tempted to quote much of the law syllabus at this point. An awful lot of tedious rote learning stuff can be better done by teaching machines, and indeed we are playing a leading role in that. Professor Hugh Collins is one of those enthusiasts who's been writing what I think is the best computer-assisted learning stuff to come out of the Higher Education Funding Council's project. But all of that is supplementary to and complements what traditionally has done. And I would rest with what I said in my lecture, that in any case, it's the ability to acquire the means to acquire wisdom that people go to universities for, as well as, you know, acquiring mates and spouses and so on from time to time. And that role will survive. It's not the information transmission role. No, no, no.
The questions are a bit difficult.
Right. The questioner asked, why did I think so many foreign students came to British universities to study? Was it not to study British institutions? And I don't think for a moment that's the motive that leads most of them to come here. We have one enormous advantage, and that is we speak a dialect of American. And people come here because they wish to study in what we choose to call English. The second reason is that we're quite good at it. I mean, higher education is something that the British traditionally have done well, as the Chileans, for example, were very keen to recognize. But that's rather an interesting society. I mean, talking to the ministers concerned, nobody suggested that they would want more than 10% of their foreign mobile students to come to Britain. They all accepted that 80 or 90% of them would go to North America. But currently, of course, about 100% do.
Why? Why do they only want 10% here?
Well, because they think that's about the right sort of level. I mean, they go to North America, of course, because that is the superpower. Obviously. I mean, just as people came to Britain and to London when we were the centre of a large empire. I mean, as one can see in Northern Ireland at the moment, you know, American empire is quite extensive.
One observation in support of your statement is most of my students have told me that they learn more from each other than they learn from
That's
the
right.
teachers.
Yeah.
And the one thing why you conquer it is the economy of the side in that district rather than the one from the community.
Sure, I mean, I should have mentioned that, of course. I mean, it's undeniably the case. I mean, the oldest trick in the game, and I suppose it was discovered in 12th century Paris, is that if you have bright, charismatic lecturers, and they had them in Paris then, Abelard was one of the sort of Mick Jagger of his day, then you congregate very bright young people together. And as soon as you have that, then you have a virtuous cycle. And that's what, in fact, university management largely consists of. I mean, for those of you who couldn't hear it, there's one of our students, rather nicely, and thank you for that, said that there was another reason why foreign students came or could, and particularly in his own case, why he came here was because we offered a particular kind of curriculum. I mean, application of information technology to social science. And that is, of course, true. I mean, this is... I tried to make the point in the Chilean context where they had realized that the University of Chicago might be everything, but it was actually an ideology, and they wanted a contrasting view. They wouldn't only want to buy that particular package. By the way, it's something that the LSE in the past was itself accused of. When I was in Jamaica, I was attacked quite vigorously from by some people in the audience who said that you know, their leaders came to Jamaica and they came back at the time of decolonialization with a bag of tools and kit which they used, and they look at Jamaica now. You know, what had I got to say about that? And I said, well, I mean, you know, whatever it may or may not be, it's a darn sight better than Cuba, which is up to the north, so you know, it wasn't the worst bag of kit around. And in any case, if you actually thought you came to LSE and got a toolkit, you were misunderstanding, because that's training, and what we hope to do is education. But it is an interesting fact that I think that is a real danger with any very potent, very powerful institution, which can be seen as rather overwhelming by some of its students, which is why I stress the importance of self-criticism as well as self-confidence.
Please. With LSE entering the 21st century, with what you said, more global attitude, and with globalism being, in a sense, multiculturalism, and also multilingualism, don't you think it may be worthwhile for the LSE to consider allowing some of its overseas students to write their thesis in some non-English languages, with the hope that such an exemption might allow them to make more genuine contribution to scholarship?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I don't think you can hold simultaneously the view that I was expressing a moment ago, that one of our, what would the marketeers call it, the unique selling point is that we speak a dialect of American on the one hand, and allow people to write theses in a non-American dialect on the other. I mean, I do think you have to decide one or the other. I would hope that the benefits of English, which is a sort of international lingua franca, are recognized, and that they would spill over into the academic work, which is done in a vernacular language. Certainly that would be, I think, the expectation. There are, of course, universities in the United Kingdom which do take that view. Welsh universities, for example, allow all their students to write their examinations and write theses in Welsh, and I've examined one, and very curious it was too. I think back to that experience and wouldn't want to generalize it. Yes, I mean, I hope I made clear that I saw our advantage in London specifically in the context of a financial market. I mean, there are other activities, of course. I mean, London doesn't seem to me to be the place to come to study how you make motor cars, for example. I'm sure the University of Warwick is very much better. In fact, I know it is, because Kumar Bhattacharya is one of the world experts on how you put motor cars together. So, I mean, it isn't generally true that everything should be centered in London. I mean, each city and city region is actually developing its own microeconomy in a very interesting way and specializing in consequence. And that leads me to the networking point, because one would network with organizations that one has something to contribute and talk to about, and obviously we will have most to say to, not necessarily the University of Warwick and the car makers of cars, but those universities in New York and elsewhere where there are viable financial markets. And one can see those networks developing very well. I mean, in the particular context of Europe, we are, through the European Institute, an acknowledged node, as they call it, in the developing network for the social sciences. I mean, this is now going much more broadly than economics and finance. And we recognize abroad those institutions like us, and indeed the European Union funds and is increasingly funding academic networks rather than setting up institutions like the European University at Florence, which I think is now generally recognized, not least by them, as being a rather expensive and low value added institution. Much more effective, they think, to fund networks, and I'm sure they're right. But this means that we actually have much more to say, for example, to the School of Economics in Stockholm or the Management School in Barcelona than we have with some institutions in Birmingham. Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. Oh, sorry. The student was complaining that here was I extolling the virtues of information technology, and he wondered when I last tried to surf on the World Wide Web or sign on or do anything as opposed to talk about it. And he said that the facilities here are deplorable and not up to those of a community college in Canada where he comes from. Well, I think there's a lot of truth in what he says. The infrastructure of the school is deplorable, and it applies not only to the information technology infrastructure, but the physical plant generally. The library desperately needs refurbishment. Some of the buildings with which we have to operate are long since past their sell-by date, which is why I made the point I did about it not being clear to me how under current funding circumstances, and of course the budget has just removed about £1 million from the bottom line of the LSE's budget next year, say equivalent to £300 per European Union student per annum, which we'll have to find from cost savings. So under that regime, there is a very real question mark about whether any British university can be said to be on track to remaining world class.
There was a question here.
Could I just draw you out a little bit on the idea of science? It seems to me that perhaps we are living in quite an interesting moment where the European Union sends up an astronaut into space and we don't have the money to get him back in time. And the largest scientific projects like the accelerator in the United States isn't funded anymore. Do you think that developments like this will seep into social science as well, as those larger scale projects are going to be abandoned? What sort of changes are ahead?
Yeah, I suspect you're right. I mean, what I sometimes refer to unkindly as the toys for the boys science, I mean the things CERN or space or all that stuff, is getting so expensive that without the stimulus provided by military need, and without the USSR there is no such stimulus, at least I can't see it, I suspect that the funding for that will tail down significantly. It'll go on, but it'll go on at a much reduced level. I think the science of the 21st century is not going to be that kind of dominating physics engineering-based science, the sort that's epitomized by those photographs of Bernal standing with his stovepipe hat, you know, cigar in his mouth, the scientist as dominator. I think the 21st century science is going to be manipulative. And what's going to be manipulated, of course, is the DNA of living organisms. It's infinitely easier to alter what's already there than to invent something new. And there are, in the laboratories, for example, of the plant breeders, the most intriguing and fascinating plants, the first tentative examples of which are just about appearing, as we speak, on supermarket shelves. I mean, that's a harbinger of an avalanche of novel living things which will be created by plant biotechnology. And, you know, if I was going to bet on where the science budgets of the world are going to be spent, then it's there.
One more question, I'm afraid we're running over.
You mentioned the possibility of an elitist breakaway from the traditional university system, and you cited in particular the possibility of Oxford and Cambridge breaking away from their own form of group. Will Ellis even win?
No, I shouldn't think for a moment. I mean, there's long been a tension between ourselves and Cambridge and Oxford, too, to a degree. And in any case, our mission is not like theirs. I mean, I'm often asked by foreigners, you know, what's the difference between Oxford and Cambridge and the LSE? And I always say it's very simple. Oxford and Cambridge are about training the British elite. LSE is about training the global elite. And in that sense, we've already distanced ourselves, if you like. I mean, the very fact that we are less than 20% dependent on the British government is in part due to the fact that we have all the foreign students, which is why we have an international and not a national mission. Until the last French election, for example, I always used to tease cabinet ministers by pointing out to them that the LSE had more alumni in the French cabinet than it had in the British cabinet. And that's often been the case. You know, there haven't actually been many prime ministers in Britain who've been graduates of the LSE, but I think we currently have 25 or 26 worldwide. So, there's really, as it were, no comparison. We're doing different things.
Thank you very much, John. I mean, I think at the end of that, one's got the feeling that those two last questions really hit the keynotes, the internationalism, and also this wonderful opportunity to hear one man who can combine in his experience the academic priorities and the particular contribution of the future in science and biology. You talked about that there's not been much of a conversation between biology and the social sciences, and in many ways you have, I think, encouraged us to think we could start the conversation and pitch us along that way. You also hit a note about, with all the professionalism, that wisdom has to be part of the formula of the future. And I thought to myself of the Icelandic saga, one country that didn't come into your range. Iceland has a saga where they talk about Snorri, who is the wisest man in Iceland, without the gift of vision. I think you gave us enormous vision tonight. I think you also gave us some courage in tackling problems that are still shaping up, and that we've got to grasp this familiar bouquet of nettles, which is the future. And thank you very much for the heartening way in which you helped us.